Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to You're on Mute, a new podcast series conceived by BBI, the UK's first Black business institute, an organisation which aims to boost prospects for underprivileged Black entrepreneurs by promoting equivalent access to the UK's funding structures and essential business networks. I'm your host, entrepreneur and business mentor, Bianca Miller-Cole, and over the next 12 weeks, myself and my fellow hosts, June Sarpong and Lord Michael Hastings, will be interviewing an incredible lineup of leaders, icons, and changemakers to ascertain how they balance the importance of commercial performance versus societal impact. As we all know, with great power comes huge responsibility, and this series looks at how those in positions of influence can use their status as a force for good. Our time together is broken down into three sections, with the guests sharing their favourite pieces of music or soundtrack representing a memorable stage of their life. Joining me today is Stephanie Fair, Chairman of the British Fashion Council and Chief Customer Officer of Farfetch, to discuss applying disruptive retail strategies to champion diversity and inclusion. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you for having me. Hello, Bianca.
So the first thing is your track that you have chosen. So you've gone with Disco 2000 Pulp, but also you said Bittersweet Symphony by The Verve. So yeah. Tell me more.
Hard to pick one song, but I guess those probably define my university life. And Disco 2000 has a bit of a nostalgic sort of undercurrent to it, and I listen to it and it takes me right back to the dorm rooms and to uni, and you think it was not that long ago, it was actually a good 20 plus years ago. So
who's counting anyway? So most people know of you as the chairman of the British Fashion Council and chief customer officer of Farfetch, which obviously is a great achievement, but I'm keen to learn a little bit more about the younger Stephanie. So from the beginning, you've been a global citizen. You describe yourself as a third country kid. Tell me a little bit more about that.
I just discovered this term actually not that long ago. It was part of the dissertation of a graduate student that I saw during Fashion Week, Condé Nast College graduate student, and it resonated because that was exactly me. So she'd also grown up in lots of different countries, like me, speaking multiple languages, and feeling that we're sort of from everywhere, but nowhere in particular. So the answer when someone says, oh, where are you from? Or is not an easy one, just because it's sort of, do you want the short answer or the long answer? But I think I also feel incredibly lucky, because it just means I've had such a varied and diverse upbringing, have met people and have kept friends from around the world, have reconnected with people from around the world. So no, I think you make your upbringing the best you can. And I was certainly very lucky to have such a global one.
And your dad, he was a banker and your mother was a businesswoman. Would you describe them as your early role models?
Always, early, mid, late stage, always. Absolutely, just really hardworking, adventurous, risk-taking. They sort of took it in turns, I think, to manage their careers, so that we always had good stability at home, which is a really good role modeling for me. And just incredibly social as well. So yes, very lucky to have the parents I do.
And you lived in a number of different countries, five countries, is that right? What were they?
So in order, born in Mexico, then Panama City, Paris for a stint, where my mother decided it would be good to learn French and get French culture and start a whole sort of French part of our education. New York for a time, Washington, D.C. That was when my father was actually working for the World Bank. And then London with a stint going back and forth to Prague.
And what were those first three initial months in Paris like?
I do have memories of it. I was small. I was 5 or 6, but I do remember being put into kindergarten, primary school. We were in the suburbs of Paris, didn't speak a word of French. And actually the teacher called my mother in after a couple of months and said, look, I think you should look into your daughter. I'm not sure she's hearing us. Could she be deaf? And it's because I was just absorbing everything, but not responding. And 3 months later, I started to speak French. And I think small kids do this. They're sponges and they absorb and then it all comes out. But that was my way of handling a completely foreign environment. Just take it all in and then respond.
Okay. So as a child, I guess you were maybe, you know, not so interested in kind of physical and sporting prowess, but you were, you know, defining your gifts in other ways. Could you expand a little bit on that?
I mean, I loved my ballet and my gym and my sports. It's just that I never got picked on the teams because okay. I was so small. I was very, very short for many, many years. So it was never the obvious pick for the basketball team or the football team or whatever other team sports. But I did do ballet. I focused on the academics. I always remember my mother saying, look, this will all come back full circle. Don't worry. Focus on what you're really good at. Do something that really differentiates you. And the academics certainly helped.
And you were so academic that you ended up studying at Oxford University. I can imagine that was a contrasting style to education in France. What was that like?
Very different. I mean, it was, first of all, full of English-speaking kids, students, which I'd not been that used to. I had to, my first few essays, I had to sort of write them in French and then translate them in English.
Wow.
So that added a load to the workload. But it was amazing. It was such a discovery, like all of us who go to university. It's just such an opening of the mind, and particularly I was quite sheltered, so it was a real eye opener, but great. And just I think the whole way Oxford works is through sort of self learning and really thinking through topics, and I think that helps for later, just analytical skills and problem solving.
And after university, you found your first job traveling again, and you had plans to go to Panama, but you ended up in New York on a friend's sofa. Is that right?
Plans to go to Argentina, actually, but okay. Yes, basically traveling, but ended up in New York, and it was a great stopover, which I never really left and didn't leave for 10 years. I managed to find a job, someone who was willing to sponsor me for a visa, which I was very grateful for, because as everyone knows, it is hard to get visas to work in the US, and someone who is willing to take a chance on me so early on. I want to say it was pre-9/11, so that bit easier to do than after 9/11 when everything tightened up. But it was just such an incredible time to be in New York, not just because I was in my 20s, but just New York as a city was really thriving. Actually, some of the songs I picked were those early 2000s hip hop that New York was all about. Wherever you went out, it was about that sort of early hip hop music. And that just takes me straight back.
Perfect, because that actually brings us into section two, where we discuss some of the traditional D&I challenges in the company. It brings us to your second track, which you said was Missy Elliott, Get Your Freak On. So tell me a little bit about what that track means for you.
I mean, I think, you know, Missy Elliott has tons of hits, yeah. Right? So hard to pick one. But I think if you listen to it, the early sort of those chords, you know what's coming. You know that song's coming. I thought I'd pick her. I mean, there are lots of male rappers, and probably throughout that time, lots of them came out with hits. But I think being a woman she particularly stands out. And I just remember just reading and seeing just how well respected she is by all of the others. And she's contributed to music from so many artists. I mean, she is an absolute legend. And I happened to go to her birthday party in the early 2000s in New York, which was also amazing and a night I won't forget. It was at Joe's Pub in New York. I can't remember the exact year, but it was really early 2000s. So she's a legend, and you hear any of her songs. And it also takes me right back.
Wow, her birthday party. I bet there's loads of stories about that.
Yeah, that was fun. That was fun.
That's amazing. So at this point, you're now working in a PR company founded by a 23-year-old woman, which sounds like a very dynamic environment. Are there any memories of those early assignments?
Yes, she's called Winnie Beatty, and she started a company called Siren PR, and I thought she just was so, you know, grown up and mature, but we were all so young, but she was entrepreneurial, and I think that was an inspiration, and she got us all to, I always joke, she sort of had a fake it till you make it approach, so she had us all answer the phone as our own assistants to pretend that our office was way bigger than it was. Yes, to be fair, let me get her for you. Of course, that was me. But it was great. It was we really hustled, and I just learned so much about business development and sales and comms and just the way the industry works. So very grateful to everyone in my career who somehow shaped it. And some people are better known than others, like Anna Wintour, and some less known, but equally impactful for me. And she's one of them.
So you then landed a key role at Izumiaki, which obviously is a quite iconic brand. What was that experience like?
I mean, I think what defines that for me was also all that, just the ability and skill set I learned working with entirely different cultures. And if you think about sort of traveling to Japan in the early 2000s, no one had mobile phones. And when you go to Japan, I'd stay in very Japanese hotels. The workforce at Izumiaki in Japan was very Japanese, no foreigners. So just communicating and getting things done and understanding the way, the different ways of working and how the meetings and how you should approach getting things done was a real learning experience that I can apply to pretty much anything. We all should try and put ourselves out of our comfort zone. And that was definitely one for me. And then working with amazing people like the architect Frank Gehry, or we hosted a musician in the store who at the time was not very well known. And he's now a sort of multi-platinum record selling pianist called Leif Ovne Annes. So just early on, that link to culture and fashion and how it all works together was fascinating. And I was so glad to have that role so young.
Did you appreciate the kind of level of gravitas that came with working with, you know, architectural legends like Frank Gehry at his new flagship store? Or were you kind of just, you know, getting on with it?
A bit of both. I know, you know, when you're younger, you just almost get on with it. But I did recognize the value of it, and just how lucky I was to be able to have these interactions. And it teaches you very quickly a certain level of maturity and how to conduct yourself and how to manage these relationships. So a good lesson for later on.
So your next move took you to Vogue in New York. Yep. What was the energy like at the time? And did you get to meet and work with the great Anna Wintour?
I did. I most certainly did. I mean, Vogue was incredible and such a great learning experience. And it is, as you imagine, it was fast paced. There's no room for error. You sort of, everybody there, you know, I often get asked, were you an assistant? Well, I say everybody was, because that's just what you did. You did what you needed to do, whether it was to get the issue out or to put the Met Gala on. And there were incredible perks, but it was also lots of hard work. I think some pretty fabulous moments. You know, my interactions with Andre Leontali were never not fabulous. And then learning from Anna Wintour, I always say I learned so much just listening. I sat outside her office, so with one ear, I could listen to how she took phone calls, connected people, interacted with people, made decisions, and those are good lessons. And I would say she's incredibly loyal, and to this day, she has always come through. If I've ever asked her for help, I regularly meet up with her, and she's supportive in everything that I do, whether it's Farfetch or the British Fashion Council. So that loyalty, I do not take for granted. And I think it shows so much of who she is.
Yeah, that's incredible. So are there any particular lessons that you learned from Andre and from Anna that maybe our listeners could take away that they could implement in their lives?
I mean, Andre Leontali is a legend. He's published a number of books. I think for him, you know, what's interesting is not having come from the traditional mold of who you might expect would end up in fashion, and he carved his way. And I think he did it through really connections and meeting people and having a point of difference, and that he has encyclopedic knowledge about the fashion industry and references, and he links it to culture and art. And I think, you know, having that point of difference and having something that you leave people with, he was able to carve his way. And certainly for Andre, it was not easy. He grew up in a very poor family in the South and found his way through. And he was never not fabulous. So I think there's something about building your brand as well in the mix somewhere there. And then for Anna, I think she's decisive. She's incredibly hardworking and a real connector in that best possible sense. It always comes back if you connect someone for funding, if you help a designer find a role, if you get together your connect. She put a group together to launch the CFDA Vogue Fashion Fund right after 9/11 to help support designers who were not able to show and whose, you know, livelihoods were decimated. So I think using her power and platform for good is something that I hope I can take into the future.
I love those three tips. Personal branding is what I'm all about. That's what I teach people on a day-to-day basis. So I love that you said personal brand, networking karma, another favorite of mine, and using your power and influence for good. Those are three amazing tips.
Yeah.
So you then went on to, I mean, probably by plan or otherwise, technology and fashion started to merge and you started working at Outnet. Tell us a little bit about what the Outnet is for those listeners who may not be aware and your role there.
So I had a little stint, Bianca, before the Outnet in the US at Portero, which was a pre-owned luxury marketplace, the very first. But you're right, I wish I could say it was all by design and I had it all figured out. I did not. And most people who think their career is all figured out, it's only because they've told a good story after the fact, right? I just fell into it. I was keen to sort of move away from editorial and more into the business side, and was willing to take really any job that would give me that opportunity. Because I didn't want to get pigeonholed into one thing. And the concept of startups was really only just beginning. I'd never heard the term startup. And that's what took me into this business, Portero, which was e-commerce and fashion. It was a marketplace. It was digital. I remember doing the first Google AdWords early on. I mean, now it's like a black box of scientific genius, how to manage performance marketing. But back then I was manually typing in the words. So that's what took me into Net-a-Porter and the Outnet. I did Portero for a few years, but it was a business that was too early for its time. It was, imagine 2005, pre-owned luxury goods. It was eBay for luxury. It was Vestiaire Collective and The Real Real and all of these businesses that are now taking
so
off.
Big. Yeah.
Should take off because so important for the fashion ecosystem. But back then, too early for its time. But I got to London and was hired by Natalie Massenet and the CEO, Mark Seba, to start and run their second business, their outlet business called The Outnet. And there was a brand name, there was some idea about what the proposition would be, but really I was hired to sort of bring it all together, really decide our go-to-market strategy, hire a team. I think the first person who was in place was a writer. called Emily London, which was a perfect name for who we needed, and then hired buyers and marketing people, all of whom I've stayed in touch with. It was an amazing team that sort of gave birth to this business, and everyone now has gone off to do incredible things, but we're very united in having had that experience.
Amazing, really amazing. And I think you're right, sometimes you just, you know, ahead of your time. It happens, yeah, in business, right?
Timing is everything too.
Yeah, timing is everything. I love that. So as we talk about timing, let's move into section three, a progressive future. And you've chosen a song, Learn to Fly by the Foo Fighters. So tell me a little bit about this song and this project.
So it's not a current song, which I know is the directive, but I've been listening to it recently. Just my husband actually found it and showed it. And it's just, I mean, you cannot watch the YouTube video and not just have these emotions well up. It's basically the story of this guy who is a huge fan of the Foo Fighters, but they'd never come to play in Italy. And so he decided that he would, I imagine through social media, he would get like-minded fans all around Italy to come together for one day only and play the song Learn to Fly all together. So they're drummers, bassists, guitarists, singers, and they've never met, and they all come together in this field and perform this song. And first of all, it's performed to perfection, but second of all, when you realize that people come together for no other purpose than art, and I just think it's amazing. It's one of those viral YouTube things that just makes you well up. But you also think, God, there's so much more than unites us than separates us. And I just, it's one of those that you think, oh God, there is a lot good about humanity. We all focus so much on the negative, but there's a lot out there, and art and music is a good way to bridge a lot of differences.
Yeah, perfect, perfect. So coming up to date,
have you seen it, Bianca? Have you seen it?
But you've inspired me to watch it.
Yeah, have a look.
But have you know, a look. You're absolutely right in that there is more to humanity than a negative, and sometimes we spend so much time looking at the news and negative, you know, literature and media, and there's so much we can celebrate together. And I think this conversation, many of the other conversations we've had on this podcast, are illustrative of that. That we can all be a great contribution to a fairer world. So thank you for that song choice. It didn't have to be modern. I like the fact that it's modern in that you're listening to it now. That is sufficient enough for me. So bringing us up to current date, you're now at this point working with Farfetch. Could you explain kind of the unique selling point of Farfetch and your role?
Yes. So I joined Farfetch. It'll be almost 5 years. I'd, of course, seen it sort of from the outside start to build up and see the proposition and understood it from the outside. But when I joined, I really realized just how incredible the vision was. And really, it is to be the platform for luxury through the marketplace, which is buying and selling. Boutiques and brands selling products to a global audience, curated luxury fashion, but also as an enabler of technology for the luxury business. As we know, back to the story about Portero 15 years ago, there's so much that the luxury industry needs to do to digitize, and technology is not easy, and it requires very specific investment and skill set. And so partnering with brands to enable them to digitize, whether it's their own e-commerce site or their in-store tech solutions to bring a kind of interesting digital approach to your bricks and mortar, or whether it's how to, you know, get into China through all of our services and gateway to China. It really is an unbelievable business that kind of takes a 360 degree approach to how it can work with the fashion industry. And back to the piece about sort of using your platform for good, given the size of Farfetch and its weight in the industry in terms of what it can do, seeing that it's truly a values-led business was also for me a huge factor in not only joining but staying and enjoying it, because it truly is a business that uses its platform for good. And you can see it from the culture inside, from how we position things on the outside. And that's what makes truly valuable businesses, I think.
Absolutely. And I guess with COVID-19 coming along, this could have been particularly devastating. And at least it was for some brands who had not undergone that kind of digital transformation process. For some of those brands, how has Farfetch been their savior?
You know, I think the business model really came into its own. It was always about working with boutiques. In many cases, some of these are family-owned boutiques that have been passed along through generation to generation all around the world, and working with brands. And for the boutiques in particular, they had not gone through, a digital, and in some cases didn't need to, because they don't need their own website, or they don't need, and this is where partnering with Farfetch really helped them. And when COVID came along and their stores quite literally shut and they had zero footfall, Farfetch was able to really support them to continue running their business. We created a campaign around support boutiques, which I think really resonated with the customer. If you remember, there was such a bigger appreciation of buying from boutiques, buying local, understanding the value that comes from where you get your goods. So I think supporting the boutiques, supporting the brands, they also have stores that shut down. And so our business model is not only set up for the good times, but as it came out, it was very, very well set up for these difficult times. And that's because of our technology, our logistics, the way we work, but also how global we are. We were able to sell into markets that were not under lockdown and restriction. We were able to sell from markets that were, and we were their only lifeline. So that was from a business standpoint, and also just a value standpoint, it was an amazing outcome. And similar to everyone else, when COVID hit, we didn't know how we would manage. It was first a humanitarian and health crisis. And the first step was, how do we take care of our own people and employees? And when we realized that we had this amazing opportunity, that was incredibly galvanizing for everyone to work towards something for good.
Yeah. And on that point of kind of working towards something for good, around a similar time, we had obviously the news of the killing of George Floyd. And that, I am sure, kind of inspired some changes in the organization with regards to kind of racial disparity. So what were your initial thoughts when that all happened, and how did that impact the organization?
I think what it did is really shine a light on what we were doing and accelerate what we were doing. So, you know, we had programs in place. We actually had our Black Employee Network that had been founded a year or 18 months before. We had done a huge amount of work around gender pay gap, and really getting data in order to rebalance. We've done a lot of work around that. But I think what it did is really accelerate and cement the fact that we needed to focus on this and formalize a lot of what we were doing, and really put resource and attention and really bring it together as also a galvanizing effort for all of our employees. Because ultimately, for Farfetchers, being in a values-driven business is important. And if you don't have, if you don't work towards social justice, if you don't work in an environment that feels equitable and fair, then, you know, you can say all you want, but internally, if you're not talking the talk, walking the walk, it doesn't matter. So we truly believe in starting with ourselves first, starting with what we can control. And so we did a number of things. We really invested in our Farfetch people communities. So really giving different communities the opportunity to raise awareness around their community and how we could really elevate their needs. We worked a lot on thinking about how we could, through our supply, represent Black designers. And I'm delighted to say that these are designers that we just needed to find and bring on board and push. And from a business standpoint, we can support. And we've continued with the data gathering. So back to your question, you know, how did this affect us? I think sadly not the first killing, but it was a tipping point, I think, for the world to realize that something needed to be done at a more fundamental level. And I think Farfetch believes that, you know, we're a fashion business. We're not, you know, we're not a governmental organization. We're not, so we can help where we can help. And in our world, which is around business, around our own employee well-being and equality. And that's what we've focused on, and around what we put out to the world, our editorial, our storytelling. And so we've really focused on what we can control. And I think we've made real strides on that front.
And during this time, you became part of a platform called Share the Mic to really discuss some of these issues. What was that like, and what were the main points of discussion?
So yeah, I did this on a completely personal level, but of course, everything I do is tied into my work at Farfetch, my work at the British Fashion Council. But a good friend of mine in the US, Stacey Bendett from the brand Alice and Olivia, had got together and had created Share the Mic in the US. And I was so inspired, and we talked about it. And in partnership with Vanessa Kingori from British Vogue, we decided to bring it to the UK and say, if this amazing initiative was created in the US, could we do something similar here? And the idea was that really, amongst all this talk of social justice and how could we create something that certainly had the outcome of giving a platform and really amplifying and augmenting voices, but talking about something else. So actually, the topic of Share the Mic was not specifically around social justice or diversity or inclusion. It was actually just really sharing platforms amongst women, accomplished women, white and Black women, who wanted to share their audiences, share their platform, to talk about the things that matter to them. So whether you know, it was Bernardine Evaristo and her book, whether it was, you know, the Chiniki Orchestra, whether it was Shannon Hilton, who's an amazing athlete, talking about her work. It was saying, well, we are so much more than our race. We are women who are businesswomen, who have written books, and how can we augment that? And I think at a very basic level, if you build bridges through relationships and friendships and show your audience a different audience, these are ways to start to move away from that otherness. And so that was the whole thinking behind the Share the Mic, and something that I really felt authentically and personally I could get behind, because I just loved the idea, that idea of sort of personal relationships bridging whatever gap might exist. And I have to say, it was one of the proudest moments for me, just seeing this come to life and how many amazing friendships and relationships were created.
Yeah, perfect. And I think that's so important, this keeping the conversation open and sharing thoughts and feelings and influence and networks is where it all starts. I think it's fair to say that, you know, the civil rights and social justice issues we recognize now have existed for many decades.
Yeah.
Do you believe there are measures that could be put in place to implement and drive change?
I think there can be, and I think it's everything from top-down efforts from companies around diversity, efforts around employment, diverse employment, you know, apprenticeship programs. I think bottoms up, it's efforts like, you know, the building bridges and understanding and storytelling. Fashion in general is an incredible cultural industry, because it tells stories in a way that affects everybody. And so we have a responsibility. I think in tech, actually, there's a lot that tech can be done. There's a huge amount that's been written about whether there are the right people sitting at the table, because algorithms define how much you know, who these speak to and how they respond, whether it's on social platforms or just simply algorithms around how you navigate sites. Do you have the right people at the table, the right product engineers? This has been a challenge for a long time, because there's not that many women engineers and product engineers, and, you know, even less so women of color. And so how do you make sure that you've got people at the table that will be able to influence how a lot of this technology is built. So I think there's an opportunity in tech to do a lot more, but it can have a disproportionate impact given how much people consume it and use it in their day-to-day lives.
Yeah. It's interesting because there are some organizations now that are stating they won't invest in companies that don't have a diverse board. Do you think that's a necessary step that we should all be taking?
I think it's the whole world of impact investing, which is interesting, which is the idea that the finance world can actually support change through making the money flow to the right places. And diversity of boards or executive teams is really important. But I think it's important to see, one, because it's the right thing to do, so certainly they should invest, but actually it's been shown time and again that diverse boards actually generate higher returns over time. So if you were just to take the economic rationale for why impact businesses or impact finance businesses should invest, it's because they will get higher returns. And I think that's okay. And that's a very, very good reason to do so, which is ultimately why the market, a sort of managed market, is the right way to approach these topics.
Yeah, it's a simple enough business case, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
At a fundamental level, how can you argue if it's going to improve the bottom line and it's going to improve the lives of the people working in and the culture of the organization? How could you not? So on the British Fashion Council, where are they in their D&I kind of journey?
So we've really progressed on that front as well. And we've always had, actually going way back till 2006, a positive fashion pillar, which was about, fashion as a force for good, a positive force for good. But as I think for everyone, the last few years have really accelerated that. And so we've worked again on internal and making sure that our board internally represents the fashion industry and who we want to be speaking to, not just our designers, but consumers. We've worked on our own employment and the team itself, and then really worked on everything that we do around our BFC Foundation and the grants that we give, support that we give designers to really make sure that we have a really, really diverse view of the industry. And as it happens, a lot of our young talent come from very, very diverse backgrounds. And so particularly because the UK is defines itself vis-a-vis other fashion capitals as being about emerging talent, this is an incredible opportunity to really highlight the diverse talent that we have. And so I would say there's always more work to do. But Caroline Rush, the CEO, and the team there has done an incredible job, and more to come around our efforts around diversity and inclusion. And I think you would say from a lot of the winners of our recent awards and grants, it's a really diverse representation of what the fashion industry is all about.
Would either Farfetch or the British Council be willing to sign up to the BBI Business Charter to drive change in a structured way?
So Darren told us all about it, and it really resonated. It really, as we talked about earlier, Bianca, it talked about the business case for diversity and the need to really support with true, capital and investment and distribution support. So we're absolutely considering it as one of our initiatives. And like everything we do, if we sign up to something, we really commit behind it. Mm-hmm. So we'll have to get the team's thinking caps on how we can really support this.
Amazing. And to my final question, I ask all of our guests to make a pledge for a better future. What is your pledge?
So I think my pledge is to keep building bridges. This is something I can do in my role. I can take my position in whatever role I have to raise people's voices, to connect people, whether it's connect an entrepreneur to an investment fund, whether it's to bring an underrepresented minority to the attention of some of our buyers, whether it's to, I'm in a very privileged position that I get called a lot for advice and mentorship and connections, and I can use those for good. And certainly if I can give someone a leg up in the way that I was helped, with a view to really help underrepresented minorities and groups that may not have had the support or attention in the past, I will absolutely do that. So maybe in one word, it's using my own platform to continue to build bridges.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time today. I have so many more questions I could ask you, but in the interest of time, I'm going to say thank you so much for joining me today and opening up about your fascinating life and remarkable relationships and, of course, your future aspirations. I know this episode will stay with all of us for a very long time, and I'm hoping that people will take heed of what you said about how they can use their network for good and how they can push for change in their own little way. So thank you so much for joining us today on BBI's You're On Mute.
Thank you, Bianca, for having me. And it really felt like a lovely conversation. I really appreciate it.
Lovely. Thank you so much, Stephanie. Please join us next time where we'll hear from another icon, business leader or famous personality. Until then, please subscribe, review and leave your feedback wherever you listen to your podcast. If you're a leader and would like to share your journey and opinion on social justice and a fairer society, please contact us on podcast@blackbusinessinstitute.com. Until next time, goodbye.